Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You are listening to Public Criminology, Academics Engaging with Public Life. Five academics discuss the role and value of criminology and academia more broadly in a democratic society. It was recorded on the 13th of May 2011 in Edinburgh.
My name is Richard Sparks. I'm Professor of Criminology at the University of Edinburgh and I'm a co-director of the Scottish Centre for Crime and Justice Research. It so happens that I'm a co-author with Ian Loder of a book called Public Criminology, which raises a number of questions about how academics in the criminology field, generally understood, engage with public life. And a group of us have got together today to have a little discussion about this issue. And we are...
I'm Sarah Armstrong. I'm a research fellow at the Scottish Centre for Crime and Justice Research based at Glasgow University. And I study and am interested in penal policy, and I supported the work of the Scottish Prisons Commission in reviewing the use of imprisonment in Scotland.
I'm Ian Loder. I'm Professor of Criminology at the University of Oxford and Director of the Centre for Criminology there. I'm the co-author of Public Criminology. In recent years, I've also participated in the Commission on English Prisons Today, and I am Chair of the Howard League for Penal Reforms Research Advisory Group.
I'm Fergus McNeill, Professor of Criminology and Social Work at the University of Glasgow, where I'm also based in the Centre for Crime and Justice Research. I worked with Sarah in supporting the Scottish Prison Commission, and also now I'm working with others on a Northern Irish prison review team. So I'm very interested in engagements between criminological theory and research and policy practice debates.
I'm Jonathan Simon. Most of the time in recent years I've been a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. This year I have the great privilege of being a McCormick Fellow and a Lieberhulme visiting professor at the University of Edinburgh School of Law. I am a criminologist. I once wrote a pretty good book that fit within the genre of criminology about parole called Poor Discipline. And in more recent years, I have kind of wandered off the reservation of criminology, and one of the reasons I was so excited about this project is that I felt like it kind of mapped the territory that I found myself wandering through.
Okay, thank you, everybody. Ian, would you mind just kicking off for 5 minutes by briefly expounding some of what we thought we were about this book?
Okay, the book is called Public Criminology? The question mark was a very deliberate insertion on our part, because we were interested in the phenomena that which the term public criminology had come in recent years to debate, which was a kind of attempt and feeling on many people who produce research and knowledge about crime and justice that they wanted to have a more intense or effective or impactful involvement in debates about public life. This was an ambition that we, like many other criminologists, shared. But nonetheless, the reason for the question mark is that we wanted to some extent, to stand back from the question of how to do intervention in our field and to think more sociologically about the conditions under which we now do it and the space of possibilities that are available under those conditions. So the book does two things. Most of it is really an attempt to try and map out both the recent history of the field and the changing conditions in which work is now done, which we describe using this metaphor of the warming up of the kind of policy environment, which is a shorthand way of describing, to put it crudely, a move from a world where policy was, shall we say, more closely informed by deliberation, by expertise, by the best evidence of what works on various crime policy matters, to one which has become much more volatile, much more emotive, much more driven by the mass media, much more the subject of political calculation and expediency, context in where it has become much more difficult to make reason and evidence the determinant of what gets said and done. So against that changing backdrop, we really try to map out a space of different kinds of styles, if you like, of how criminologists have kind of understood both what it means to kind of practice criminology and how these particular styles might kind of engage with questions of public life. We call these the scientific expert, the policy advisor, the observer term player, the social movement theorist stroke activist, and the lonely prophet. And then we partly try to articulate a different and to some extent different conception of what that relationship might look like, which builds upon and tries to bring into dialogue those positions rather than just sweeping them to one side, much of which has to do with how those who produce knowledge of crime and justice think about and orientate themselves to politics, both in terms of how politics and political institutions actually work as they are currently constituted, and to what we describe as the kind of unrealised promise of modern or democratic politics. Part of that has to do with trying to develop a better understanding as criminologists of the institutional context, the many and varied institutional contexts within which knowledge circulates and may or may not have effects, but also has to do with trying to cultivate a particular kind of disposition as knowledge producers towards that world, something which has to do on the one hand with first and foremost being committed to producing and being a bearer of knowledge about the world. Secondly, to kind of realising that intervening as a knowledge producer in that world, while it requires a certain degree of political nous and skill, is not the same as being a politician or being a lobbyist or being a victim advocate or being a law enforcer or whatever, any other kind of mode of being in the world of crime and justice one can think of. And that thirdly, that one cultivates a certain attitude of humility towards what can and cannot be accomplished when one does that, which is not about fighting shy of what one feels one knows as a criminologist, but kind of recognising that any kind of criminological work or evidence should not be in the business of trying to trump what are probably political contests, where there are normative disputes, where there is kind of reasonable disagreement about courses of action, and rather thinking of the role of the criminologist as being one of unsettling, provoking, prompting discussion, questioning common sense and cliche, not trying to close down the debate.
Now, we call that position that of the democratic under-labour. I don't know whether we will have cause to regret using that particular form of words as we go on in life, because it hasn't proved universally popular with everyone, but maybe that we should spend a couple of minutes just saying why we put these two terms together, democratic and under labour, and what we think we mean by especially the latter, because it's not self-evident to people. Under labour is a term that we borrowed from the philosophy of John Locke, who in fact said it was the role of the philosopher, and he described it at the end of the 17th century as being, if I remember the terms quite right, The role of the underlabour is to clear the ground and take away some of the rubbish. In other words, whether or not you need to adopt a kind of, that doesn't commit us, I don't think, to adopting a kind of Lockean worldview or any such thing, it was simply that what was attractive about that, I felt, was that it situated he deliberately depicts the philosopher in this case, which is in many ways the grandest, kind of the biggest beast in the academic jungle, in this very lowly role as somebody who tries to do something useful, but it's also arduous. I mean, it is a labour to clear ground and take away rubbish and so on. But the reason we put these two notions together was that, what is it that criminologists labour for? Our argument is that criminology labours in the service of democracy, by which we mean developing a more fruitful, more deliberative, and in those senses, better politics of the criminal question. A question which is so often debated in ways that are unhelpful, restrictive, imbued with all kinds of negative and problematic emotions, and so on and so forth. And that if we wish to reconsider what our role as academics are, we need to reconsider them in a fairly kind of top-to-toe, thoroughgoing way. The term is an attempt to reconcile some of the things that Ian was just mentioning, which is to say a role as some kind of specialist with something to bring to the table that is different from merely lay knowledge, but on the other hand is deployed in conversation, in dialogue, in process, and not flourished as a kind of argument finishing trump card. That's what I think we kind of thought democratic underlabour was. Now, Jonathan is on record as having been underwhelmed by this term, and I just wondered whether he'd like to say any more about that.
I would, and I, as you know, I'm deeply sympathetic to the project, and indeed recognise myself, even though I get in the book characterized as a lonely prophet, which is never a bad thing, I think, certainly not a dishonorable thing to be. I actually aspire myself to do something, I think, closer to what they describe as public criminology or the democratic underlaborer. I had sort of two problems with the term. One, it's a purely kind of nominal, and one a little bit deeper. The nominal point is simply that you're taking a very complex and subtle and novel idea and using a deeply obscure phrase to remind people of it. I mean, maybe ordinary people in the United Kingdom understand what an underlaborer is. Maybe in Locke's time there were a lot of people running around who were underlaborers, and everyone would have known, just give a shilling to the underlaborer and he carts off the rubbish or whatever. But I think it's a term that just doesn't exactly open windows suddenly. You kind of have to go, what the hell is that? So that's, you know, it's a minor point and one that can be corrected in future volumes, or maybe you'll just bring back the popularity of the term. when Sarah described herself as a democratic underlaborer, I almost heard her, I thought she had said an underpaid laborer. That I could understand well in the context of today's academic communities. The deeper point, which is a kind of comparative point between the United States and Britain, and to use their metaphor of the temperature going up, I have to recur to an old joke that Johnny Carson used to show on every night on the Tonight Show. He would always ask, because it was in L.A. or Beverly Hills or downtown, beautiful downtown Burbank, I guess, that the show was set. And, of course, it's very warm there. And he began every show by saying, you know, how hot is it? And I guess that's the question I have for these guys in a way. I mean, how hot is it? I hear them, in a way, saying to criminologists, well, if it's too warm in the room, take your jacket off, roll up your sleeves, and carry on. And my concern is that it's just not that hot in the United Kingdom compared to the United States. It's a little harder to say that in a world where it's at Baghdad heat and it's 100, you know, it's 45 centigrade. Sometimes just rolling up your sleeves won't do. And I have often felt myself as a criminologist in the United States recurs to sort of a nightmare that I think many people have, that was captured by Lewis Carroll so well in Alice in Wonderland, of being in a room that's getting smaller and smaller and smaller and trying to fit your body into an increasingly constrained space, trying to do honest criminological work, which I took to be helping government solve the problem of crime, given America's commitment to penal harm as an overarching philosophy and an extremist version of risk management. An increasingly impossible task. One either had to paint oneself out of that picture completely and say, I'm a critic, I'm a revolutionary, I don't believe in this system anymore, or one had to somehow take another pill and go back to doing something that one didn't believe in. And, you know, when I wrote a book called Governing Through Crime, which was my, either could be seen as my lonely prophet, Jeremiah, or hopefully, in my view, hopefully a road to a kind of public criminology, part of what I wanted to do there was flip that around and say, you know, this is not about helping government solve the problem of crime. It's about helping us recognize that what we have been doing is using crime to solve a problem of government. And unless we go back to talking about what those basic problems of government are, we're in a trap. So I recognize in Ian and Richard's book an insight about exactly that point, about reopening the discussion of what politics is rather than focusing narrowly on crime. And I'm very sympathetic to it. I just worry that the image they have is too gentle, too British in a way, because, after all, this is a much more deliberative political society. I mean, you have prime minister's questions. We had George Bush, who actually could not have survived 1 minute of prime minister's question time, but nonetheless got elected at least once to the United States presidency.
I think he wants to come
just
back.
Just say one or two things before we throw it over. I have an awful lot of sympathy with that, and I think one of the reasons for the qualifier democratic in advance of underlabourer is it does try and focus the question on the matters of politics and government, not on the question of crime, and to locate what we're thinking about there. And it may be that the notion of a better politics of crime is a bit too anodyne and could be improved. But we were, by talking about that, we were trying to focus criminological mind on that question, not just on the question of how can we do something to reduce crime or reduce the prison population. Now, in that context, I think there are just two things worthy of saying. That there, in terms of what the book kind of suggests the criminological ambition should be about, it is about, no, primary empirical discovery of the sort, you know, we're all used to, just carrying on doing the work and hoping it has greater effects. But it is about two other things. One is the kind of effort to try and understand sociologically
politically, historically, why the context in which we work have changed. And it is about trying to make a room for a different kind of work, which you could describe, if you like, as normative, but is about, as criminologists, thinking about the kind of institutional arrangements that give rise to the circumstances we find ourselves in and how they might be different. And I was reminded, because we've all been at a conference and people have been trying to dissect the penal state over the last 2 days, that Andrew Abbott wrote recently. He said that the main responsibility of the intellectual or the sociologist is not critique but vision. And I was reminded, and I think the book is partly trying to remind us all of that, because it's partly trying to say that it's a legitimate function of those who do research on crime and justice to try and cultivate a greater sense of institutional imagination when it comes to the question of how our societies frame, think about, and respond to crime and penal questions.
Well, that's easy enough for you to say.
How do we go about that?
Somebody write down vision so that we don't lose it and come back to it. But I want to go back to under-labouring, because I think by the time I was reading the book in transit between Glasgow and Belfast, going to meetings, doing stuff.
Yeah.
And I found it hugely helpful to be reading it in that context, but it also meant I was reading it in a hurry and reading it in airport lounge. And I think by the time I got to democratic under-labouring, maybe I've lost the nuances or the subtleties of what you meant by it. I mean, I liked the term. I was kind of attracted to the idea of playing a role in fostering a better politics of crime and justice rather than trying to sneak in wisdom through elite networks, which mm-hmm. seem profoundly undemocratic. So that appealed to me. But now that you mentioned the waste clearing theme, mm-hmm. I get even more attracted, because, of course, what immediately springs to mind in the Scottish context, and for a scholar of community sanctions, is that democratic under-labouring is criminology's community payback.
Oh, very nice.
We put on our bibs that label us as criminologists, and we go into the fields of policy and practice, and we try to take out some of the more toxic influences on the way that policy and practice is constituted. And that sounds noble and good, and also worthy of public investment. It's, you know, it kind mm-hmm. of pays our dues in terms of public service, a public role, and contributing to the public good. But Jonathan's response kind of begs a couple of questions that, to put it crudely and to play with the metaphor for far too long, how big does your shovel have to be? And when is it better to go straight for a bulldozer? And also, what do you have to wear when you're doing it? Reflecting on some of the conversations we've had today, mm-hmm. do you need a full, one of those protective suits that mm-hmm. Takes the nuclear risks away from you while you clear that stuff? Or is it just a case of stripping off because it's a bit warm and digging it up and getting it out? So I think there are some really profound questions about the different contexts, the different democratic contexts for yeah. different kinds of under-labouring. But I don't want to lose track of the vision thing, so I'll stop there and let somebody else.
Well, I'll just come in at that point and hopefully closing off the under-labouring conversation. It's just at a very more basic level, the title of the book is Public Criminology. So to some extent, what we've been talking about is how academics talk to policymakers and politicians. And it strikes me that it's unclear, who are academics meant to be engaging with? Who are the audiences within the book? And I think the larger question that looms for all of us as academic criminologists is, who are we trying to speak to? Who do we have a right to speak to? And what do we have to say, as specifically as criminologists? What is it we bring to this conversation? Mm-hmm. So if it's a public criminology, it seems like so far we've been talking about engaging with the public, but only via politicians or policymakers, in a way that maybe astrophysicists don't talk about exclusively engaging with policymakers. They've got popular science shows on BBC. Yeah. They've got other forms of media.
Yeah.
It's where do we find that space, and what is that space? What is the evidence that we uniquely can shed light on? And is it evidence? You know, what mm-hmm. anymore amounts to evidence? Because I think maybe one of the crises the book is inspired by is by this ambivalence about what is the evidence we produce. Is it statistical, objective, factual information? Is information about how angry people are about crime or about justice, mm-hmm. is that evidence? And how do we communicate that, and to whom? So I know that Jonathan, for example, is involved in a blog that's a public blog based on his book, Governing Through Crime. And I don't know, Do people write to you on that?
I'm too technically inefficient to figure out how to put a counter on it. I'm sure there's a way to actually to measure how much traffic I get on it. But I'm always surprised at how many people send me emails, reporters, sometimes government officials working in broadly in criminal justice will send me an email. I also get comments that I do post up on the blog, so it clearly gets read. I was attracted to it, I think, first in a very just instrumentalist way that I, not unlike some of the other folks around this table, I have a hard time finishing a book because I still am not certain I've said all I want to say about the topic. So I mean, well, a blog is the perfect solution to that. You just get to keep running on into infinity, and if no one wants to read it, that's up to them. But as it went on, I was attracted to two things about blogs. One, there's something that anybody can do. I mean, I don't even have a fancy sort of university-hosted blog. It's actually a blog spot. It's owned by Google, actually, the platform for it. And anybody can open a blog. It can be a blog on, you know, raising pet turtles. It can be a blog on, you know, breastfeeding your baby. And it may have no readers, or maybe your mom's reading it, or maybe there's hundreds of readers out there that you don't know. But the fact that nobody needs a PhD to do it, or the money to open up a radio station or a newspaper, was very appealing to me. The other thing is that there's a kind of informality to a blog that is certainly one of its downfalls for people coming to it expecting a more guaranteed and certain, you know, evidence-based, because it's an opportunity to vent, to speak about feelings as well as about observations or insights. And that struck me as something that oughtn't to replace the other things we do as criminologists, but maybe there's room in the space. I like the shift from temperature to space metaphors here, which I've already mixed in terms of too hot and too packed. Of course, physicists would tell you they go together at some level, but I won't try to map all that out. It is a question of opening up new venues for engaging. And so one thing I have found, and I bet some of the other people here have found, is that you get calls by the media, and they know you're criminologists, but that, for them, that can mean, well, you can comment on whether the defense lawyer in some case for murder is making the right argument, as well as on some kind of CSI questions about whether or not particular kinds of stains could really have been shown in somebody's bedclothes or whatever, many topics in which I have no opinion, no expertise, etc. And what I found interesting about the blog, in part, is that reporters do read them. They especially read them if you link to their articles, because they follow that line back. And it means that you then show up in their vision of the world as already located in a set of things that you're concerned about, not the things that they are on a daily basis pursuing. And so I found I was getting more educated calls from reporters who would now come to me specifically to ask about the latest expansion of prison sentences in California or parole policies about sending people back to prison, that gave me a much stronger and I think more effective posture with the media. So that's been some of my experience so far. I don't know whether it's not sort of a grand solution, but it's I'm very much taken with Pat O'Malley's recent invocation of an image of Gilles Deleuze, is that we need to find lines of flight, and lines of flight are not they're not clear strategies to solve big problems. They're literally like you're walking through the woods and it just feels like it's opening up a little bit more this way. I'm going to walk this way for a while and see how that works. I think we're in that kind of time, and that this is one kind of space.
I think what's frustrating to academics is you often get exchanges with policymakers where they want an answer to a specific question. And maybe the one I'm thinking of that I got recently was, do we have any evidence that people released from prison 2 months before their sentence is over reoffend at a worse rate than people released 3 months before their sentence is over? And there's no evidence on these kinds of questions, and there's no answer to that. And you want to talk about how that's kind of question that can't be answered. And I just realized that this expectation that we can provide expertise on tap shows that there's not only is there an identity crisis among academics about what our public role ought to be, but there's a crisis among others about what our role can be, what we know, what we don't know. And so I think you're just mentioning in your blog, Jonathan, that it's just taking different paths with Pat O'Malley's thing about taking different paths. I think sometimes the biggest impact, the biggest role, and the biggest impression we can have for the level of vision in thinking through better solutions for society in the area of justice have to do with trying to, oh God, I'm getting back to the under-labor thing, of just showing where we're going and just saying, well, that question presupposes that early releases from prison have anything to do with somebody's ultimate desistance from crime.
But that's interesting as well, because the question reframing, which I think is a hugely important intellectual academic theory driven, actually, well, in some respects, contribution to public debate, is not what we're usually asked for. You know, we try to frame questions differently, but most of the time we get the wrong kind of call with the wrong kind of question and have to react to the frustration, or worse, answer the question on the basis of something other than expertise or evidence. And that also, you know, to give you an anecdote which may cast me in a negative light, well, I'll give you the anecdote anyway. I came out of practice into academia, and this was back in 1998 after maybe 8 years of different kinds of social work practice or social work training. And the day that I crossed the academic threshold, I became an expert. Now, the day before I crossed the threshold, I was a social worker in a community working with people on probation orders and parole orders, and nobody asked my opinion about anything. The next day, I had an office in an institution replete with symbolic and cultural capital, and suddenly I was an expert, not because I'd done research, but because of the office I occupied. And I was offended by that. My first reaction to that was to be offended and affronted on behalf of all the colleagues I'd just left behind, and of course on behalf of the professional identity with which I was still, in which I was still, and to some extent still am, invested. So later, years later, I heard one advocate of evidence-based practice of the narrower form critiquing what he calls eminence-based practice. And much as I would disagree with him on what evidence means, I sympathise greatly with the critique of eminence. And it's a seductive thing. It's a temptation to just fill the office, be imbued with with the privileges that it brings, and then pontificate. But the entitlement to different forms of dialogue. The blog thing is interesting, because I think in a blogging identity, even as an academic, you're able to give yourself permission to speak more freely. I don't have the experience. You do. I think you have every entitlement to speak. I should underline strongly here. But do you speak when you're talking about blogging? Do you feel freer to express yourself in terms of your beyond evidence, beyond, do you understand?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel freer to talk about essentially my feelings or my response to something, and then to try to turn a more critical gaze on that feeling or that response. Recently, and somewhat controversially, I blogged on the killing of Osama bin Laden, and I began by mentioning that, ironically and creepily, like the weekend in which the raid was happening, the conversation had come up in my house about 9/11, and we had told our kids about it, and I found myself getting very upset, and actually saying to my brother-in-law, I wouldn't mind hearing that Osama bin Laden had a bullet in his head. It came out. He didn't even provoke it. And then he did, and I felt okay about that. And so I needed to write about that, and it, made me very nervous, because I also feel like it's a war crime to go and try to kill somebody when you can easily capture them in a non-risky way, which I don't think they could have done in this case, by the way. But the point was that I felt it was, I wouldn't give a conference paper on that, in which my own emotions were part of the evidence or examples to be picked apart. In the blog, I somehow feel like nobody has to read this if they don't want to. Public listening can be very uncomfortable. If you're at a conference as a professional, in a way, you have a duty to be there. Your university has sent you there, paid for it, etc. And if somebody is saying something that's very offensive or very troubling to you, it can be an emotionally difficult thing to have to listen to that. Well, nobody has to listen to my blog. They can just click away from it and hit the reverse key and boom, okay, They're somewhere else.
I think the point about eminence-based policy is quite a powerful question. I remember rather distinctly having a conversation with a very eminent, originally British academic, now working in Italy and for some quite long time, who said that the problem in the environment he felt he was working was that it was only public criminology. That is to say, there was a kind of bricks without straw quality to the ways in which criminologists or other academics sometimes, I guess, would engage in public life, and it was very much based on the kind of prestige of their positions, etc., rather than really being kind of backed up by any very great claim to have done the hard work that would justify holding those views or exerting any great influence. So there's certainly no sense, in anything that we write in the book that I think would justify that. But on the other hand, I don't think Jonathan's blog is anything remotely like that. And I'm reminded in that case of that ancient but rather attractive cliche about journalism that it's the first draft of history. Mm-hmm. And there is something about certainly the blogging response as a public intervention that is, you know, partly attractive by virtue of its immediacy and its kind of responsiveness. Mm-hmm. So this is mm-hmm. how we saw it here now. You know? I think that's
a question. Would you rather listen to somebody who has an authoritative grasp of a field pontificate about it, speculate, ruminate, or would you rather listen? This is obviously going to be a both answer. Would you rather listen to somebody who's done a very specific study of the 3 months versus 2 months question, right, using an absolutely robust experimental design and proven, in inverted commas, which you can't see on the audio, that, you know, the correct pre-release arrangement is 6 weeks after all? I raise the question to give you an example. A colleague who published a chapter in a recent book I edited and whose work I respect and whose friendship I value, so I hope you're going to take this in the right spirit, referred to his chapter as being about technology transfer. And what he meant by that was that we have used the best scientific methods to develop a technology for practice, and now we're studying how to best transfer the technology into practice. And I, during the process of editing the book, said I really find that very difficult language to describe the knowledge exchange with which I'm keen to engage, because it implies something about, you know, who's entitled to invent the technologies that determine practices and on what basis. So that's kind of behind my earlier question, which I then didn't allow you all to answer.
Well, one of the things we get ticked off for by some readers of the book, not that there have been that many readers of the book, probably will be, but I think that was not choosing. We'd be too nice to too many people and asking them to be too nice to one another too much of the time. I think there's a certain sense in which we think that's inevitable, indispensable, and desirable even, because you know, the knowledge system in which we are now engaged willy-nilly in this area of life, as in almost any other, is multidimensional and is only going to get, you know, more so, if anything. So they're trying to kind of say there's only one royal road, only one way of doing this, only one posture or one position or one role or persona that you can occupy vis-a-vis these things is simply unfeasible in a world which is characterized by expertise, as it were, at every point. You know, from practice at the most kind of basic frontline level through to you know, the higher echelons of policy making and management.
Let me ask you both a question then about the five categories, because most people's reaction to the categories is to try and locate themselves or to resist the categories, you know, which is obviously a natural reaction.
It's what Louis Macon calls an egological reading of the book.
You know, we're all human. We've all got ego. So, but that's if you don't do the other job, is to try and locate all your favourite people in these categories, which is a different one. But is it more honest then for a criminologist to recognise themselves and be that, and to be read as that by all of their audiences? So that I develop technologies and I transfer them. I don't pontificate on normative questions, and I don't extend into that territory because my expertise claims are of a specific sort, and it's not appropriate for me to stray into territory that doesn't belong to my skills and frameworks of expertise. So that's it. Or, which is the reason why I'm asking the question, I feel I flit between your categories, and sometimes I wonder if I'm being honest enough about when I'm moving between a kind of normative, theoretically informed, critical position and an evidence-based argument for a change in practice strategy. Should I float between, or should I?
I think part of the point was to say that yes, you can float between, and you don't have to kind of name the fact that you're doing so every time that happens. I mean, the book has been read in that kind of way for all sorts of very human reasons, but there is a subtle thing that happens in the book that kind of no one has noticed. Maybe it's just too subtle. Is that when the typologies are introduced, we kind of float names around in a way that some people have found slightly irritating because they think they've been misplaced. When they reappear at the end of the book, the names disappear.
Yeah.
And the disappearance of the names is very deliberate because part of the point we're wanting to make is to say that it doesn't make most sense to think of these things as identities towards which one should cleave, but as ways of operating in kind of political space that, depending on the context you work in, depending on the particular moment you are of your career, depending on the institution in which you're kind of located, you might end up moving in and out of those different ways of working, using different forms of knowledge. And I think that's there aren't genuine points of epistemological and political disagreement. There aren't, and in that sense, in some cases, choices to be made, that the landscape isn't as fixed as some people try and make it out to be.
But presumably when I move, are my dispositions or my identity shifts from one to the other, I must be clear about the nature of my engagement on that occasion. Because if I have an identity as an evidence-based whatever it is, and then somebody asks me a question which I answer, but not on the basis of the evidence claims that I'm usually known to use. I'm not explaining this very well, but
I mean, can I let me say a couple of things. As an example, I want to give, because I think it illustrates some of this. But I mean, it relates to also what Sarah was saying about all audiences. I think part of what we were trying to do in the book was to open up that question, not least because I don't think we've got any kind of hotline to truth on how criminologists should engage and what audience they should engage with. So part of the point was to say, well, let's not just think that government is our audience, even though they're often the major funder of what criminologists do. The audiences could be, you know, pressure groups. They could be, there's all sorts of ways in which you can intervene in spaces of spaces of culture, spaces of public life in which you can intervene. Secondly, to say to people that most people now know this, that this kind of intimate, it's not linear. It's not that you do X with institution Y and then Z happens. That often it's very indirect. It's about long-term relationships, as Alison Liebling was discussing in a conference this afternoon. And that we should try and operate with a more capacious sense of what evidence means than many in the field have been minded to do of late, where it really is about turning up with your experiment and saying, well, here's my experiment, it shows this, and you need to do that, therefore. And of course, the background to that is in part that for all the constraints that academics now work under, I think the university, and we need to be aware of those, the university remains an institution in contemporary Western societies where you can say things that can't be said in other bits of the criminal justice state. They can't be said by people who run the bureaucracies because they've got budgets to protect and jobs that they want to keep. And they can't be said inside the political field because the political field has games, has rules, which are interpreted by political actors as closing off a whole bunch of things that just have become publicly unsayable. And one of the things that you can do as a knowledge producer is say things that are publicly unsayable, and it seems to me, and without sounding too pompous about it, that seems to me to at one level to be one of our responsibilities because of the job that we do.
I think that's really valuable to bring in the role of universities as sort of a fundamental feature of being an academic criminologist. And it made me think there, then, what is the difference between being a university-based criminologist and, say, a think tank? Because a think tank, in some ways, are very much in the business of being public intellectuals. But there's some agenda being pushed. There's clearly a vision being pushed in the work that think tanks do. And I wonder if criminology in universities in some ways has become reactive, has lost its vision, is reactive either to funding agendas, whether those are government funding agendas or research funding agendas, instead of leading with particular agendas or programs for reform. And it seems like the book that you two wrote is trying to find some space for that. But how do you do that? It's not you don't move from these identities of being an academic as policy advisor, academic as political, talking truth to power politician, without some sort of costs. Mm-hmm. So it's not that you can just be one day and one the other the next. How do you navigate that? How do you envision that actually happening? And are universities the only place that can happen?
I don't suppose they are. I mean, I think it would be very wrong to understate the role in the worlds in which we try to move, and some kind of nearby ones of NGOs, for example. They could be really important generators of ideas and concepts as well as... I don't think universities are in any sense the only venue for that kind of... In some ways, for all the reasons you've just described, they haven't been doing the greatest possible job of being that venue. And we should be particularly aware, I think, in the course of this conversation, that five of us sitting around this table have some relatively protected and cocooned situations from which to speak. Many colleagues just don't. They're from the terms of which their funding works, the remits of their jobs, and so on and so forth. People feel differently, but in some cases acutely exposed. So it's not just about some kind of generic sense of heat out there in the world that makes it harder or easier to raise these issues. That people have differing degrees of support, differing degrees of permission, so to speak, to engage. But I think the issue is that people, that is not to try to make this simple or to resolve it in any way, shape or form, or to produce any kind of final menu, recipe or prescription. Only to say that, you know, from all of the different vantage points in which people find themselves, some of which are in all kinds of ways problematic, some version of these questions comes up, because there doesn't seem to be any likelihood that we can conduct criminal justice policy or practice or wider political discussion without reference to versions of expert knowledge or versions of scientific research somehow described. That, I think we know that from so many fields of activity now, that these questions kind of are pervasive.
I mean, I do think the university professor, especially a protected one, you know, with a secure employment, especially at prestigious universities, have a distinct role to play here. I mean, a couple of years ago, Ian had an exchange with then Prime Minister Blair on Blair's website, essentially. I mean, as part of what began as a conversation, but then it became an exchange of, or at least you sent him and was posted on the Prime Minister's website, a set of responses to his views on New Labour's crime policies. And it strikes me that, you know, the head of an NGO that does a lot of work for the government can't do that. You know, somebody in the Home Office or other ministries can't do it. A lot of university researchers who are dependent fully on essentially getting government grants can't do that. So there is a role for, in some ways, the classic university elite professor to take up that role, and it's a very important one from that point of view. I wonder if we could learn something by sort of looking at the other side. All right, in the United States, it seems to me the buildup of the war on crime, and especially the very toxic form of mass incarceration we've embraced, was very much facilitated or promoted by certain public intellectuals. James Q. Wilson is somebody who I would nominate near the top of that hierarchy. So he wrote a book called Thinking About Crime in the mid-70s, in which he helped to, it was a very accessible book, in which he helped to sort of dismiss a whole set of criminological questions about crime and focus on punishment as the main way that we ought to deal with crime. A bit later, he wrote an article called Broken Windows, which again purported to be kind of grounded in science or experimentation, but then became a hugely influential path towards zero tolerance policing, not just in the US but around the world. So I wonder if, you know, I could say a lot about what I think or don't think about Wilson. We could also mention John DiUlio, whose notion of super predators helped to really cue up very harsh policies toward juveniles. To John's credit, he's essentially admitted he was wrong and kind of publicly silenced himself, which I think may be a problem. We should be hearing from him now that he has a different vision of it. But can we, in a sense, learn something from the effectiveness of what I would think of as, you know, the wrong side of public criminology in the 70s. You know, presumably they were learning. One of the reasons Wilson was so successful is that academic criminologists who disagreed with him didn't really venture into that public terrain. It was almost a decade later that Elliot Curry wrote a book called Confronting Crime, in which I think he actually offered a really powerful rejoinder to Wilson. But the fact that there was like a decade and a half in which there was essentially silence within that public sphere had some effect. I'm not saying that alone or any book changes policy, but it empowered a lot of thinkers. And I think that empowerment role is an important one. I was recently in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and went to a session of talking about, based in the schools, about how to prevent school leavers and whatnot. And Professor Phil Scraton, who's a criminologist, offered some very critical perspectives on over-punishment, over-criminalization of working-class youth in Belfast. And I was watching, and it was like, nobody who knew Phil's work would have been surprised that he had those views. But in a way, they opened up space for some of the other people at that conference who were practitioners, who were working for the government, to say things they wouldn't have otherwise been able to say by leaning on his criminological status, in a sense.
That's a great example, and one that raises a kind of... Well, I'm reluctant to say this again because I don't want to get hung up on the topology, and you know, one of the problems with the book's reception is that the wrong bits have attracted the, you know, too much comments. So I don't want to go back there, but one of the things I like about Phil's work and the work of people like Phil, I don't know how he would have been classified in the book, but I, as somebody who is actively engaged, sometimes by choice and sometimes by accident, in policy and practice discussions about what the evidence means and what the question should be, even if I'm lucky, I find it very helpful to be reading people who are standing further. That's not, it's actually a poor example because Phil's much more engaged, deeply engaged in all sorts of ways. But others, maybe David Garland's a better example of somebody who's standing back, taking a bigger view. And I find that somebody who's sometimes, to use a metaphor that we talked about today, down in the swamp, if you can read something that's been written by somebody on higher ground, then that has a very helpful way of encouraging one to stay honest, or at least to challenge yourself to be professionally reflexive in the mire.
I think that's actually as good an ending point as we're probably going to get.
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 2.5 UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.